Wait, plastic food cream?
Like food right. models.
Food models.
Oh, okay.
But his thing was cream. He made these cream art sculptures.
So his plastic was the material, but it's made to look like real cream.
It looks
cream,
like whipped cream.
But the
whipped
cream Sunday, looks like a sculpture. Sunday. A sculpture out
cream,
of the...
Cream-themed sculptures.
So like a rabbit, plastic cream rabbit.
That's really convoluted.
Cool. Was it kind of artistic interpretation, or was he trying to be like, you know, so it was indistinguishable from the real thing?
It was artistic interpretation. Uh-huh. But also just trying to bring, I don't know, happiness through whipped cream.
That is mantra.
We're just mere know. Heathens, not art critics. We should probably not try to understand.
Well, I'm not judging. I find it fascinating. I just want to have all the answers.
Welcome, ladies, gentlemen, and cheapos, to another edition of the Tokyo Cheapo Podcast. I'm your host today.
It's Chris's announcer voice. Sorry.
Yes, the ostentatious cheapo.
Ooh, ostentatious.
My ostentatious announcing voice.
Oh, okay. That's why you had the voice.
And I'm joined by
the abominable cheapo, Greg Lane.
I like that one. And the alleged cheapo, Taryn, and also the producer. See, now I sound lame for always using the same adjective, but it's just loyal. It's consistency. The consistent cheapo. That sucks. Yeah. Sounds even worse.
I think it's good. All right. Like, I think you can use that one a little bit more.
Okay. All right. It still has some mileage left in it.
Marvelous. So how are you both today?
Pretty good. This is the first time the three of us have been recording
together.
Yeah,
it's been the first time for a while.
In a really long time. Yeah. Like... 2 months? Is that right?
At least 2 months. Shit. Wow. Maybe three.
And podcast world probably hasn't been that long. It's
podcast world, I don't think any time has passed. Because time doesn't move in podcast world.
True. It's always whenever you're listening to it, isn't it?
Yeah.
But we've been batching them all up. So a few very busy days before I took off for some travel in Europe and then straight back into the hot seat.
Yeah. You guys just got back from Hong Kong, right?
Yep.
Yep. We were there for the few of the protests. Not really. I mean,
really?
No, we were there when the protests were happening. We weren't
were
right
really?
In the thick
That's
of it.
Cool. You didn't join the protest.
We saw some of the kind of peripheral, kind of creative protesting.
Okay. Like, it's meaning?
So, for example, there's some areas where people have put loads of stickers up. You know, there's lots of.
They call them Lenin walls. Yes. Yeah, after John Lennon, not the
not with an I.
Vladimir Lenin.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but yeah, we didn't, we're during the week, and I think when it's like a big mass protest, that's normally at the weekends.
Oh, okay. I mean, they were daily though.
Yeah.
Or so
yeah.
The news is saying.
Yeah. We saw some Lenin walls and, so yeah.
Cool.
We were there, but for the most part, it was business as usual. So, who wants to tell their story first this week? Any volunteers?
Who's got the best story?
Oh, it's always Taryn. Taryn
will usually
tell
stories. Yeah.
Well, hey, maybe you should go last. Okay. All right, I've got a sort of not even a story really. It's more like a tip. When we were coming back from Hong Kong, Greg and I were on the same flight, and as we got to the immigration area, Greg went right and I went left, and Greg was like, "What's going on? Has Chris made a mistake?" He's like, "No, no mistake." So I'm going to the automated gate. And also sometimes when I'm arriving on my own, there's usually some immigration staff to guide people, mostly the foreign tourists, to the right place. And they see me going off to the left, where the Japanese people are. They're like...
They try to stop you.
Like, no, they try and point me the other way, and I just sort of stride past them confidently.
Yeah, you gotta.
And
put them in their place.
I've got my sticker in my passport, because I registered for the automatic gates.
Oh, okay.
So have you registered for the automatic gates?
No, I've not.
Have you registered?
No, I haven't. No. I haven't. Obviously not.
This is a pro tip.
Okay.
It's very easy to do when you leave flying out of Japan. Before you go to the passport desk, you've gone through security, but before the passport desk, there's a little kind of office on kind of one side of the room, which does the registrations for the automatic gate.
So you do it at the airport?
Yes.
Weird.
And it only takes about 2 minutes. Mm. You fill out a form, show your residence card and your passport, and they put a sticker in your passport, and then you can use the automated gates.
Cool. Is it free to do the
It's free, yep. And, you know, there's almost never anybody queuing to get through the foreigner automated gates.
There's a special, special automated gates for foreigners. Yes. Right. Oh, okay. Cool.
So, I mean, maybe I'm famous last words. Now I'm announcing this to the world. Everyone's going to do it, and next time there'll be a queue. But normally I get through immigration so quickly because I just walk, scan the passport, do the fingerprints, and then it takes like, you know, 10 seconds. And anyway, that's my sort of tip stroke story.
I think the best part of that is that you can just feel like a boss straying past the immigration officer being like, I know what I'm doing. I'm going to the automated gates.
Yes.
I feel like that sense of power just going to the reentry permit line.
Yeah.
Because they also give you a bit of a look. They're like, should you really be here? Because you're blonde. You probably don't belong here. But yeah, so that makes you feel pretty special. But that's next level.
Next level, yeah. So, Mr. Lane, do you want to go next?
Sure. So my story's, I didn't actually get my Olympic tickets, but I got approval to buy Olympic tickets.
You have to get approval?
Were
they checking?
Well, the thing is, there was a lottery for the tickets. So, like, a few months ago, everyone had to, if you wanted tickets, you had to apply for the different events. Yeah. So I applied for, I didn't apply for the opening ceremony or the closing ceremony like a lot of people did. I thought that's going to be impossible, so I kind of aimed at events that I thought I could get. So I targeted the stadium, and the family like volleyball, so I played for that as well. So the women's volleyball.
Cool.
And just because I thought perhaps those are going to both be really popular, I'll apply for something else.
So is it unlimited how many you can apply for?
I don't think there's really, I mean, they're quite expensive if you apply for a whole lot. So I guess, you know, it's as much as you want to spend.
So you pay to apply for these events?
No, no, they've got prices. So you apply to be able to win them in the lottery, and then you get the right to pay for them.
Okay.
And then you have to purchase them straight away. Otherwise, you lose it.
Okay. So you could theoretically apply for everything. And then if you got a bunch, you could just renege on paying and lose the ticket.
Yeah, you could. But I imagine you probably have to pay for all of them, otherwise you'd lose all of them, if you know what I mean.
Oh, interesting.
So you wouldn't like be able to just pay for the ones you wanted.
Gotcha. So, okay. So you need to be a little careful.
Yeah. So I also applied for canoeing, I think it was. Like this whitewater canoeing.
Oh.
And I thought, you know, not many people are going to be interested in whitewater canoeing.
Sure.
But I got the result, and I didn't get the whitewater canoeing.
Hmm.
I didn't get the stadium, but I got the volleyball.
So. Oh, nice. So the family will be happy.
Yeah. But, I was surprised. I assumed, you know, going for kind of crappy seats in the stadium, I'd get them, but...
Maybe everyone was thinking that, though.
Yeah. Maybe I should have gone for the more expensive ones or something.
Yeah.
But, so I think there's going to be a few more rounds. I think that's usually how it works. For some reason, they kind of continuously release tickets.
Mm.
So part of it is... the tickets are kind of sucked up by all the foreign travel agents. So they have, they'll have like, you know, blocks of tickets allocated to the different countries. Like, you know, the US might get a few hundred thousand, New Zealand will get a couple of thousand, you know, the UK will get, you know, so many. And apparently what a lot of the poorer countries do, which is a bit sad, is they sell all the whole block to another country.
Aww.
So,
that's a shame.
And they get some cash, I guess.
Yeah.
But, if you're outside Japan, I guess what you do is you go to a travel agent, you buy your tickets, you get it from the official people.
Gotcha.
And if those aren't sold, I think they come back into the pool and then people in Japan can apply for them.
Mm. But do the people in Japan get the most tickets then? Because it's in Japan?
Well, they get first dibs, I think.
Cool.
Yeah, but I think going forward, you're probably going to struggle to get tickets even now for the main events.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's so many people in Tokyo.
Yeah.
Mm. So if there are more tickets released, there's so many people to hoover them up.
Yeah.
So that's my story. So I got my Olympic tickets.
Cool. Did you apply for tickets, Chris?
I didn't.
Neither did I.
I was put off by the idea of queuing.
Oh, the queue. God.
I can't queue.
Yeah.
They had the same system for the Rugby World Cup tickets as well. So you basically go to the website and you have to wait hours and hours before you can actually buy the ticket. Wow. And if you don't sit in front of your computer and you miss the slot, then it resets. And
oh, man. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, from Olympics craziness to Taryn's crazy story this week. Mm. What are you going to delight us with this time? I don't know how crazy it is.
Well, I did do a bunch of my own traveling while you guys were gallivanting around Europe and Hong Kong. So I've lived in Tokyo for like 5 years and I haven't really done anything outside of Tokyo. I've never experienced Japanese life outside of the big city. So I wanted to do something completely different from my Tokyo life. So I went on workaway.info and you can find a bunch of different like random farms and just like random little jobs and projects you can do workaway, which means like you don't get paid, but you get free accommodations and free food. Yeah, it is kind of like woofing, except woofing would be specifically organic farms.
Okay.
So a lot of the jobs have nothing to do with farming. So I chose just like basically Nagasaki, Fukuoka area and had like a specific time window that kind of narrowed down my options. And I found this tiny island called Ojika Island that's it's off the coast of this port called Sasebo. It's like close to Nagasaki, sort of close to Fukuoka. But
are there like 99 islands off there? Like it's like
it's probably a lot. I mean, in the Ojika archipelago, I think there's like 19 islands, and then this Ojika is a main island or something. So I found a job on the island, which was this family-run ryokan. So I went down there and it's a really tiny island, bigger than I expected it to be though, actually. You can explore the entire island by bike and it'll take you like the whole day to do it. It's not walkable or anything. But basically it's there's the main ryokan house and then he also has another guest house in the back and stuff. And then there's this share house where the workaways live that's in front of the property that's like an old traditional Japanese house. And it's really cool. It's quite old and a little bit run down, but it's really beautiful inside. So I was living there with, I think, 6 other workaways that were also working at the inn. So basically, we would wake up at 7:30 and then we would get out and walk over to the ryokan to get there by 7:45. And we would sort of serve the guests breakfast and also eat our own breakfast at the same time and then clean up. And then we would clean the hotel for the morning. So we would vacuum and clean the bathrooms and reset the futons on the tatami and things like that. And then after that wrapped up, we would do what Tayo, the manager, called desk work, which was us sitting on our laptops and like blogging about the inn or something. And then we would have lunch after that. And then we had the whole afternoon free. So after lunch wrapped up around like 12:30, we were off until the dinner service started at 6:20. Mm-hmm. So me and my work boyfriends would just explore the island for the whole afternoon. And Tayo had these awesome electric bikes that we could take for free. So we would go on electric bikes and bike all over the island and go to the beaches. And there was another island connected by a bridge to our island. So we would bike over the bridge and go to the other island, which looked like the English countryside when you get there. It has these dramatic cliffs and these green expanses and it looks really English. Or we'd go to these other beaches that were just totally remote and completely abandoned. Like the residents occasionally would go, but mostly they were just completely empty. Right. These white sand beaches. It looked like you were in Thailand or something. So yeah, it was really amazing.
Wow. So this whole thing's free. Is that the idea? It's like,
Basically, Tayo, the manager, wants it to arrange it so you don't have to spend any money the whole time you're there visiting his island. All the food is free. Mm-hmm. The accommodations are free. And I basically didn't spend any money. I mean, I would go to the grocery store sometimes and buy for the house coffee or snacks or whatever. But besides that, I really didn't spend any money for like 10 days. It was awesome.
Nice.
And it was just such a nice lifestyle. I don't know. It's like it was so different from living on the mainland, especially in Tokyo. You just sort of realize that a lot of things that are essential here are not essential, and everyone just kind of relaxed into this a little bit more minimalist existence. I don't know, just like little things, like none of the girls would wear makeup and you just didn't really care about your appearance for 10 days. And then even though our share house had really excellent Wi-Fi, for whatever reason, we just didn't really watch much TV. Like we would watch Stranger Things together, like the new season just came out. So this English teacher on the island would come to the share house after dinner and the group of us would all watch Stranger Things together. But with that exception, we really didn't use the internet too much while we were in the share house. So the girls would be painting. They were really artistic. So they would paint or draw in the sunny hallway next to the windows. And I would join them in like read or write or something or work in the podcast. So I don't know. We were doing our own little projects and living this much more like minimal existence for a little while.
No convenience stores? No convenience stores.
No supermarkets. Okay. Just these little markets where you can buy some snacks and stuff and produce. But
sounds great.
Yeah, it was really cool.
To do something like that. Go and clean a ryokan and do nothing for 10 days. It sounds amazing.
It was really awesome. It was a beautiful island.
I'm wondering about that bit where you said you had to do desk work with blogging and stuff.
So basically, Taya wanted me to write just one article about the island for him to publish on his blog.
Okay.
So when we finished cleaning, we would basically, that was the easiest part of the work because we would just sit there and drink coffee. And I was mostly writing my own stuff. Like I was mostly journaling and writing for my own blog, but I did write one article for him by the time I finished. But basically it was just downtime to write before lunch.
Right, right.
Yeah. But one of the girls was putting together a video for the inn, like promoting the island or something. So she's working on that video. And then another girl was doing like a English and Japanese type blog for the inn.
And remind me, how did you find it again? What's the...
Workaway.info.
Workaway.info.
Yeah, just found it there.
So Workaway.info, is that a worldwide thing or is it just Japan?
Worldwide, okay. Yeah, my friend told me about it who had done it in Ireland, I think. So yeah, it's all over the world. You choose like your country when you get to the homepage and you see what jobs are available. And then you just email, or not even email, you message on the site the people posting the jobs and say what your skills are and what you want to do. And yeah, Tayo got back to me very quickly and it worked out.
Nice.
Yeah, it was really cool. And it was really, like, I really loved the Workaway girls that I hung out with. And
yeah.
They were very cute and they made me a little goodbye present. Right. It was so cute. I like cried a little bit. One of the girls, Francisca, came down with me to the ferry while I was leaving to give me the little present that they had got me, which was this thing from a cafe that we had gone the day before. And it had all these cool little tchotchkes and, I don't know, bath bombs and stuff. And I was very obsessed with it.
What's that?
Tchotchkes, just little knickknacks, little silly things. I don't even know.
Is that a Japanese word?
Tchotchkes?
Yeah.
No.
What is it?
I don't know. It's used a lot in the States, though.
Okay.
Tchotchkes.
Maybe Polish or something.
Probably. So they had bought me a little bath bomb from there. And then in the bag that it came in, they had written messages or in like little doodles. It was very, very cute.
So, nice.
Yeah.
Well, great story. Didn't disappoint.
Thank you. Thank you.
So let's move over to events. Greg, what's your event you're going to tell us about this week?
I am going to talk about the Koyanji Awa Odori Festival. So this is kind of one of these franchise festivals. What that means is like there's a big main like festival somewhere out in the Japanese countryside, and they have a version of it in Tokyo. So it comes from a place called Tokushima. The Awa Odori is this very synchronized dancing.
Mm.
Mm.
And there's kind of like two teams. It's like there's this kind of team at the front where they have these handkerchief with it tied under the nose. You know, like they have shorts and a happy coat on. And they do this kind of dance with fans and they put it, you know, it's quite animated.
Mm.
And they tend to go first, and then afterwards you've got the woman in the yukata, and it's very synchronized, and it's very kind of graceful, and it's a lot smoother. Wow. And they have these kind of taco hat things. It looks like a that's the only way I can describe it. It looks like a
bishop hat.
It looks more like a taco. Like a taco shell.
Yes, yeah.
Like an upside-down taco shell?
Yeah, upside-down taco shell.
The taco meat would be falling on your head?
Yep, exactly. Gotcha. So, and it's a competition, so there's teams. Each team goes along the course, and they go past a judging area, and there's, like, that's usually the most well-lit part of the course, and there's, like, you know, they sell tickets for that. But if you just want to turn up and watch, it's completely free, and it's kind of quite unique in Tokyo, so I'd recommend it.
Yeah. Well,
it's on the 24th, 25th of August.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the evening.
And there's also a lot of food stands around and stuff, right?
Yeah. It's a huge festival.
Yeah, it's pretty packed usually.
And it's a huge weekend, actually. It's the most amazing event weekend of the year. You've got the Awa Odori Festival on, you've got the Asakusa Samba Carnival, you've got the Yosakoi Festival in Harajuku and Omotesando, and there's also an event that Chris is going to talk about.
It's also the Azabu Juban Festival, which is another great festival. It's a foodie festival. It's all the different cuisine of Japan, or many of the different cuisine of Japan are on sale. So it's all this. It's all about eating. So it's very popular. It's also very popular with younger crowds. I'm not quite sure what the backstory is there, but
it's Oshare.
Area is Oshare.
Azabu Juban is a kind of upmarket just behind Roppongi Hills.
Yeah,
it's really good fun, and it doesn't feel quite traditional like lots of the summer matsuri do. I mean, it is a traditional matsuri, but it's more like just a sort of, you know, younger crowd of Tokyoites having some food and banter together. Yeah. So that's it's a good social festival, I think.
Lots of good craft beer.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So do Awa Odori on one day and Azerbaijan on the other day.
Yeah, perfect weekend.
So what are you going to tell us about, Tara?
So mine is the next weekend, I believe. So it starts on the Friday the 30th, and then it continues through the 1st of September, which is the Sunday, and it's the Tokyo Jazz Festival. So even more non-traditional, but also like pretty famous, pretty well-known festival. And there's a lot of different venues around the like Shibuya, Harajuku area hosting shows, but cheapo tip, the shows are expensive. So you can also just go to performances for free by just going to Yoyogi Park. Mm. And there's a bunch of performances from the jazz musicians that are totally free in the park. Mm. So I recommend just going to Yoyogi Park and checking out those.
Great cheapo tip.
Yeah.
So as usual, tokyocheapo.com/events to find out what's going on in Tokyo. So that's our events roundup for the week. Let's now go over and invite Selena Hoy, our guest for the week.
Did we introduce her?
I am going to introduce her.
Okay, now. Sorry, so go right ahead.
Selena is a professional writer. She's, of course, written for Tokyo Cheapo and many other famous publications, which we'll find out about shortly. So let's invite Selena on to join us. Welcome, Selena. Thanks thanks for coming to join us today. You are famous for many things, in no small part writing for Tokyo Cheapo.
Well, first and foremost.
But
it's her main claim to
fame. But before you reach the zenith of the height of Tokyo Cheapo, you've written for, you know, The Guardian, Playboy, lots of kind of major publications, BBC, Independent, lots of British publications.
Mm-hmm. The Atlantic as well.
Mm-hmm. Atlantic. Yep. Mm-hmm. So, welcome. We're honored to have you join us today.
Good to see you, Chris.
Yeah.
Hi.
Maybe let's start with the standard question is, what brought you to the shores of Japan?
What's the story there?
The backstory.
Well, I'm Japanese-American. And when I first came to Japan, both my mom and my sister were living here. My mom was born in Tokyo and my grandparents were living here. I have aunts and uncles here. My mom was taking care of my grandfather. My grandmother had passed away a year before and she was taking care of my grandpa.
Uh-huh.
So at the time that I came, I had like half of my family here. And then they eventually, my grandfather passed away. My sister finished college. They moved back to the States and I didn't.
Mm.
Right. I stayed. So.
So did you come here for work? I mean, obviously your family was partly here, but were you coming here to work or to study? Or
I came here. I just finished my undergrad.
Okay.
So I came here and just did the English teacher thing because that's what you do.
Did you do JET?
I didn't. No, I just found a job at an Eikaiwa down the street from my grandparents' house.
And, what was that like?
It was okay. I was there for quite a while, maybe 5 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And got my feet.
Were you kind of exclusively doing the Eikaiwa or were you working on your own projects on the side?
For the first maybe couple years, I did Eikaiwa, but I was always a writer and I always I blogged. And this was during, you know, the height of blog mania. You know, about 10, 15 years ago, blogs were really a thing, right? Not so much anymore.
Yeah.
But, so I blogged and then I started getting little kind of guest spots and small writing assignments for other blogs.
What was or is the name of your blog?
I'm not going to reveal that. It's really dusty and it's really, you know, amateurish, but you could probably find it.
What's how did you sort of transition from your initial years doing Eikaiwa and blogging into professional writing?
When you blog and you put yourself out there and you have, I guess, observations that are a little bit deeper than maybe other folks who are coming and just scratching the surface. You know, I was lucky to have that kind of access. I guess I got enough notice or cred that other people asked me to contribute to their blogs and got a few paying things. I think Ping Mag. Do you remember Ping Mag?
Ping Mag, yes.
Yeah, I contributed to Ping Mag back. It was a really cool art magazine.
That was awesome. Website, magazine.
Not around anymore.
Yeah.
They restarted it, but inexplicably, they kind of they ran out of money like about 10 years ago, and instead of just kind of like reducing the output, he just closed it.
Wow.
Yeah.
And like, I think all the articles were offline and stuff. Mm-hmm. It was
it was a beautiful site.
Yeah, so. It was. And it was revived, I think, probably about 4 or 5 years ago, but I'm not sure if it's really taken off.
Mm-hmm. So it's about art, mostly?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I think from there was CNN, actually.
Really? How did that happen?
I just knew somebody who was editing at the time, and he gave me a chance to do some short things and a few longer things. And
cool. What were those first articles? Do you remember?
I wrote about a guy who made plastic cream art.
Plastic cream art?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
He made very cute kind of plastic food cream and put these cream sculptures.
Wait, plastic food cream?
Yeah, so, you know, like kapabashi plastic food.
Like food models for restaurants. Food models.
Oh, okay.
But his thing was cream and making everything. And he looked like a host. And he, you know, he made these cream art sculptures. So that was one.
So it was plastic was the material, but it's made to look like real cream.
It looks
cream,
like whipped cream.
But the
whipped
cream looks like a sculpture.
And then he would just make
a sculpture out
cream,
of the
cream themed sculptures.
So like a rabbit, plastic cream rabbit.
That's really convoluted. So
or just you know, shortcake. But
right.
So it would still be food that he was sculpting from the plastic cream.
it was variation. Plastic cream was his like whole shtick.
What was it? So, was it kind of artistic interpretation, or was he trying to be like, you know, it was indistinguishable from the real thing?
It was artistic interpretation, but also just trying to bring, I don't know, happiness through whipped cream in an art form.
We're just mere heathens, not art critics. We should probably not try to understand.
Well, I'm not judging. I find it fascinating. I just want to have all the answers.
And actually, another one that I did early on, I was writing for CNN right around the time when the earthquake happened.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And I had volunteered for Second Harvest. And I was actually taking the NGO management course at Temple University Japan. And so I got to kind of combine two of my passions, which is social work and writing.
Yeah.
Cool. And I got to write about Second Harvest and what they were doing in response.
Can you give us a quick explanation of Second Harvest?
Yeah, so Second Harvest is probably the first and most well-known food bank in Japan. And so they collect as much food waste as they can, still edible food waste as they can, and then try to redistribute that. They do a soup kitchen every week in Ueno Park. Oh. They distribute food to orphanages and elder care homes, and they do disaster relief as well.
Their CEO or their founder has like a fascinating backstory.
Mm-hmm. Charles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, like I learned about the founder in a chapter of my English school's textbook when I was a JET. That was like one of the chapters in the textbook was about this guy. And he, before starting Second Harvest, I imagine, lived as a homeless person for like 6 months or something to see what it would be like to be homeless. So he was living in, I think it was the river here that has like a lot of homeless people living along the river. I really want to get him on the podcast, actually.
Yeah.
You should call him.
Yeah. So I feel like you've kind of been combining those two as much as possible since then, right? Like you still do a lot of volunteer stuff. And
I do. Well, so I work now, I'd say I work part-time at TEL, which is the mental health nonprofit organization. And then I also always have writing projects going on.
Cool.
So I am trying. The two don't cross that often, but I do it when I can. I try to marry them.
What do you do at TEL?
I'm the outreach coordinator, and so I get to go out into the community and talk to people about mental health.
Cool.
And go to schools and go to embassies and community organizations and pubs and wherever.
Does TEL stand for something?
It used to stand for Tokyo English Lifeline.
Right.
But TEL is no longer just in Tokyo.
Yeah.
The services are, the lifeline is only in English, but the counseling services are not only in English.
Yes,
we have people who speak various languages, therapists, and it's no longer just a lifeline.
Yeah. There's also counseling psychotherapists available at TEL as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kind of longer term sessions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So the lifeline is free and anonymous. And then if people need more than that, then they can go and get therapy. But the therapy is not free. It's sliding scale.
It's, yeah, subsidized.
If you're yeah, it's based on your income level.
Based on income.
They're pretty flexible, but I actually see a teletherapist, and she's amazing. Their office is, like, really close to here.
Yeah, it's down the road here.
Yeah. So we kind of jumped ahead in your timeline a little bit.
We did.
Yeah, but if we go back a bit to you're in the Aikawa, but and you're starting to pick up jobs. So take us through the transition of you're no longer Aikawa. You're fully committed to the writing stuff.
So I worked at an Aikawa, and I also worked for another company teaching business English in a in a big tech company.
Oh, cool.
And I did that for quite a while, too. I think 7 years I was there. And I think really the catalyst for me quitting was the disaster.
Really?
So I was at the one Aikawa for about 5 years. I was at the other one for 7 years. And then the disaster happened. And I had already been kind of trying to see what I could do to learn more about the NGO scene, to do more volunteering. And so when that happened, I ended up kind of dropping everything and moving to Fukushima for about a year. And that is when I really kind of quit the English teaching. Yeah.
What were you doing there in Fukushima?
I worked doing animal rescue.
Oh, cool.
It was actually, I wanted to help any way that I could. And they were the first people that could take me. And so I just went up for a weekend and ended up basically staying for a year.
Wow. And what were you doing?
We built a shelter from scratch in the city of Inawashiro, which is where I lived. It's a beautiful city on the lake near, under Mount Bandai. Everyone should go there. It's gorgeous.
What was the name of the city again?
The name is Inawashiro, and it's on Lake Inawashiro at the foot of Mount Bandai in the kind of in the Aizu region of Fukushima.
Cool.
It's really beautiful. So we were going into the zone and getting out animals that had been abandoned or who had, you know, run away because it was such a chaotic time. You know, all the people had to leave. They were not allowed to take their animals into the shelters. And so they just had to leave their animals at home, which was really wrenching for a lot of folks. A lot of people, that was their family.
Did you collect farm animals as well?
We did take care of some farm animals. We took care of some cows. We transported 80 chickens to Shikoku at one point.
Right.
Oh, wow.
We were taking care of chickens. But we had this whole thing called Chicken Wednesdays where we went to the zone and put on full chicken radiation suits and brought them food and water.
Wow.
Until we were able to transport them.
Oh, poor chickens. Chicken they don't have Wednesdays. Radiation suits.
That sounds like the name of a band or something.
Yeah, it sounds like a dinner special in a restaurant.
Except that we brought the dinner. We're eating the chickens. Exactly. Yeah, it was dinner special. We brought the dinner for the chickens.
True. So, did you have any like big reunions with pets you had rescued and their families that had evacuated?
Yes. There was one set of dachshunds who actually alerted their people that the tsunami was coming. They were barking and barking and they wouldn't stop barking.
Wow.
And finally, like the family was like, oh, there's something's wrong. And so finally they, you know, started realizing what was happening because the dogs were barking and they packed them into the car and they started driving away and then they got caught up in it.
Wow.
And the dogs actually got stuck in the car. The people got away. The dogs, like the car was swept away.
Oh my God.
But they were able to find the dogs later.
Amazing.
Yeah.
They were found by this shelter?
The dogs, not by our shelter. We ended up taking the dogs in for a little while because they were not allowed to have the dogs in the evacuation
shelters. Right. How did they find them again then?
But they found their car eventually after they were able to go back and try to figure out what had happened.
Oh, wow.
They found the car and the dogs were still in the car. And there was some, I don't know, like a bag of bread. And the dogs had eaten a bag of bread.
Wow.
But they said those dogs saved my life.
Wow.
And we, you know, had the privilege to take care of the dogs for a little while those people were trying to figure out where they could go and have their animals.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of stories like that from that
That's
time.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So what was the next move after? And how did you kind of leave Fukushima after
shelters? I was there and I came back to Tokyo after about a year and got a job through a temp agency at a big tech company.
Uh-huh.
And I was working at in a fluorescent open plan office tech company doing quality assurance.
Okay. What was the tech company?
Am I allowed to say it? I guess I was working at Fujitsu for a while.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, doing testing voice recognition software for navigation systems.
How'd you like that?
It paid money. The people I worked with were nice.
Yeah.
It was interesting, certainly. It was really interesting, but it was just I was broke after volunteering for so long, and I needed to just buckle down and get a real job that paid money.
Yeah.
So I did that for about a year and a half, and at the same time applied to grad school to do social work.
Oh, okay.
So while I was there, I applied and got into a program and ended up going back to school for my master's in social work.
Cool. And where was that school?
And so that's in Portland, which is my kind of hometown in the States.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And I was able to do my social work degree partially in Portland and partially in Japan.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I was able to do my first year in Tokyo at Japan Association for Refugees.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
What were you doing there in that organization?
We did a lot of just intakes. You know, people walked in off the street with their suitcases and said, I'm a refugee. I just got off the plane.
Wow.
Taking people to hospital visits, taking people to figure out apartments, lots of stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Japan famously grants very few refugees residency.
Yes.
Here. It was single digits or something at one stage, wasn't it?
1 year it was 11.
Mm.
1 year it was 27. Mm. So there are a lot.
27 people?
27. Yeah.
In a year?
Yes. Japanese what? Government. So there are a lot of applicants, and many, many, many of them have a strong case. They fall under the UN definition of refugee, if you read the definition.
Yeah.
But they are not granted.
Why?
Japan is very strict about the people they let in, and so.
Yeah. It's,
so is it? It does that mean that it's up to every country to come up with their own refugee guidelines, even if the UN has its definition of what qualifies?
Yes, every country gets sense, to decide themselves.
It's messed up. 11 people, Jesus. It's terrible.
So this is probably at the same time as what Germany let in, like a million or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Jeez. I wonder what those 11 did to qualify. Or if it was just random.
But just to clarify, that's being granted like permanent right to remain. So refugees do come here. They're not just like sent back straight away. They kind of stay here in a sort of legal limbo. Is that right?
Yes. So it can take about 2 years to process an application. Yeah.
Okay.
And so people are often in legal limbo while they're waiting.
So if your case is resolved in 2 years and it's denied, as it seems like it usually will be, what do you do at that point? Where do they go?
They can keep trying to appeal, or they may have to leave the country. Some people are deported.
Deported to where, though? They can't return home.
Well, you're not. So it's actually goes against the UN Convention to send people back to the countries where they are fleeing from. Yeah. But
that makes sense.
It still happens.
So they're just sent back after
sometimes
escaping here?
Sometimes.
Well, presumably the rationale is they weren't deemed to be refugees.
Exactly.
So they were sent back.
So they're safe to go back even when it's
Or a lot
clearly
of folks
not.
End up in detention.
Right.
Right.
In detention?
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people in detention in Japan.
In Japan?
Yes.
Detention for what offense? For
overstaying, working while you don't have a work visa.
Jeez.
There was a story just a few days ago about a Thai tourist. Did you hear about that?
Mm-hmm.
A few days ago, she was in Ueno Park, and here's a useful tip if anyone's coming to Japan. If you're a tourist, it's actually illegal to walk around if you don't have your passport.
Really?
So this particular Thai woman was walking through Ueno Park, as you know most tourists do.
Yeah.
Without her passport, and she got rounded up by the cops in some kind of sweep.
Sweep? What do you mean?
Like a sweep. They basically sweep the area for...
For tourists?
No, not for tourists, for illegal immigrants.
So tourists.
Apparently around Ueno there are a lot of snaku, and maybe like snack bars and maybe hostess bars that have people from Southeast Asia working there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so she got rounded up in that, and it was reported to the police, like the people she was traveling with, they said, you know, she's disappeared, maybe she's been kidnapped. And the police didn't get back for quite a while. Uh-huh. And it turned out that they had her.
So they pretended she was missing?
Well, I don't know the exact story, but there was obviously some really poor communication within the
So the people she was traveling with thought she was missing, at least, and she was in detention, basically. How long was she in police custody?
I think it was like 24 hours. You'd be reported missing and then figured out.
Is it up to 72 hours or something they can hold you without charge?
It's like 27 days.
What?
Yeah, yeah.
And then they can rearrest you again.
Oh, my God.
Well, there's a certain procedure thing. After 72 hours, they have to rearrest you or something. Mm. I'm not sure. I'm not a legal expert.
I think it's 27 days.
Or yeah, I think that's... Well, like if you look at Carlos Ghosn, he's been in and out of, you know, detention for a lot longer than that.
So what happened to her in the end? Did she get back to Thailand successfully?
I don't know the end of the story, but... It's pretty bad publicity for the Japanese government, hopefully.
Anyway, back to Selena.
Yeah. How did we get lost on that tangent?
Lots of tangents.
It was something about refugees.
Oh, because you were working with refugees.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Fell undocumented. Down that rabbit hole.
Mm. Yeah.
So you were working for the tech company for a bit, and then where'd you go from there? How did writing come back up?
Well, I think I kept writing throughout all of this. I had I can't remember when I started writing for Cheapo, but it was
fairly early.
It was quite early.
Probably 2014.
2013.
Freelancing was my only income for a while.
Okay.
Because I didn't go back to the Eikaiwa after Tohoku.
So what was the process for, like, I wouldn't say stepping up, because obviously, you know, Cheapo was the peak of... But, you know, like the big international publications like The Guardian and The Atlantic and all those kind of stuff. Like, how did you start to get into that?
That's what everyone wants to do, is get into that stratosphere.
I guess it definitely helped that I had CNN early on, I think. But also just regularly writing and publishing stuff, no matter where it is. I find that Japan is really hard for a lot of different reasons to write. People can come and write kind of surface level articles, but language facility, contacts is huge. Relationships is huge. And so just having been here for so long and having, you know, gone and done so many things, gave me a lot of cred, I think. So when those editors were starting to look for folks to cover something, I could say, oh yeah, well, you know, I do know somebody in that industry and I have that contact. And so I got some of those people to trust me. I think The Atlantic was pretty big for me.
Yeah.
And it just started out being the editor wanted to cover this. There was a TV show. It was my first outing, Hajimete Otsukai. It's this show where they send really little kids out to do their first errand. Kozuke.
Oh, cute.
Yeah. And it had gotten a little bit of international attention.
Yeah.
And so she wanted to know why. And I think the easy answer to that would have been, oh, crime is low.
Mm.
Right. But I got, you know, I do know people here, and I knew people who had studied various, you know, social phenomenons and people who work in academia. And so I started having conversations with some people that I knew about, oh, why is it that kids can go to school without any kind of supervision? And we would never think about this in the States.
What's the answer?
And it's really about more like social contract. And it's safety, but it's also the way that we kind of agree to take care of each other in some way in Japan. And just explored that, and it seemed to really strike a note with a lot of people. It went really viral, that article.
Cool.
I remember that article. Yeah.
So when was that Atlantic article? Do you remember what year was that?
2015.
Okay. So that was like a pretty big like breakout moment. Were there other moments like that, other articles that were like kind of launching you?
It's honestly, once you get a couple of the bigger bylines, it's much easier to get the others.
Yeah.
You know, you have a portfolio and you show that you've got chops.
Mm. Yeah. So did you, like, now that you kind of had a little bit of legitimacy from The Atlantic or whatnot, were you reaching out to, like, The Guardian, BBC, trying to, like, proactively get them to hire you? Or were you getting calls from them?
I do occasionally pitch, but honestly, a lot of them, and I was talking to Chris about this earlier, like, either get recommended word of mouth, you know, editors talk to each other and they share names. And then also being on Twitter really helps. Mm. I've gotten several jobs through Twitter.
Wow. I mean, obviously you've hit like quite a level of success with your writing, but what's like your future plan? Are you going to keep looking at more publications, or what are you thinking?
Yeah, I have some more publications. I have. I'm not going to divulge the exciting interview that I got offered this morning. Oh. But if it comes to pass, then I'll know about it. It's pretty cool.
Would it be someone we've heard of?
Yes.
Okay.
Can you tell us after we shut the mics off?
Yes. Cool. So we'll see if that comes to pass. Other than that, you know, I have some goal publications that I'd like to work for.
Such as?
I haven't cracked Nat Geo yet, National Geographic. Cool. I'd like to write for them. That's one.
Okay.
I've got a decent portfolio going, but I want to keep getting better. I'm going to do a writing retreat in October. First time I've done that. There's a friend of mine is putting together a writer's retreat down in Shizuoka in October. So that should be
cool.
So
you're going to go to like an isolated area to just focus on
at Onsen Ryokan. Okay. We're renting out some rooms and going to like sequester ourselves and write, but also come out for community and chats and things.
Cool.
So, oh, nice.
I like that idea.
So marvelous. Thanks. Thanks for joining us, Selena.
Thank you.
It's been great hearing your stories. If people want to commission you articles or read your work or find out more, where should we direct people?
My portfolio is selenahoy.contently.com. Email? Do I want to say my email?
You don't say your email. Where would people kind of go?
You can find me on Twitter. It's Anelles, which is my name spelled backwards, A-N-E-L-E-S.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so my bio's there.
Splendid.
Too. Cool.
Marvelous. Well, thanks everyone for listening. Don't forget to give us a rating and subscribe. We'll be publishing podcasts every 2 weeks on a Monday, so every other Monday. And of course, if you have any comments, suggestions, complaints, or want to send us
stories,
any
presents.
Yeah, questions.
Questions.
Maybe we'll give you a t-shirt or something.
We'll give you a t-shirt, yes. Send us an email.
Send us a good question and you get a t-shirt. That's pretty easy. That's a good bribe.
So that's podcast@tokyocheapo.com.
Or a good story. Good story, good question equals t-shirt.
Yeah, we could read out reader stories as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Excellent. Well, thanks for listening. See you all next time. Cheerio.
Bye.
Johnny.
See ya.